Morning, ma'am. There it is. It's all right there.
But I didn't order anything.
Yes, you did. I have it right here in black and white, all the paperwork. You paid for it. You got it.
Well, what is it?
Well, let me see. 1 XMI Abrams tank, 1 Minuteman III ICBM missile with hard silo, 1 spanking new Trident submarine with Trident missile, and 1 medium tank of nerve gas. I think that's it, ma'am.
I didn't order that. I don't want that stuff.
The paperwork says you did, ma'am. You paid for it. Remember? Right here. $1.8 million for the tank, $40 million for the ICBM, $1 billion for the sub, and another $10.5 million for the missile, and a bargain, just 10 bucks for the tank of nerve gas. You've been paying for it right along, 40 cents to the tax dollar. Sometimes these payments really pay off.
Well, I don't want them.
Look, lady, I'm only trying to do my job, see? They told me to deliver this stuff, so just please sign and tell me where to put it.
Okay, well, I'm not going to sign for something I didn't order.
Well, where should I put it?
Well, put the tank along the curb. What the heck am I going to do with the tank?
It's up to you, lady. Plant petunias in it for all I care. What do you want? What should I do with the ICBM?
Good Lord. What am I going to do with that?
Well, I'd sink it in the front yard. You can change the targeting around any way you want. Each of those warheads will hit just a few yards from the target.
I don't want it in my front yard. You'd have to dig up my tomatoes. And I'd rather have tomatoes than a missile.
Lady, do you realize how much safer you're going to be once those missiles hit there?
Safer? You've got to be kidding. When the neighbors see this, they'll have a fit. They'll all be scared to death. And besides, it's hideous. Do the Russians know I've got it?
Oh, sure. They've got satellite reconnaissance, no problem.
Well, get it out of here. I don't want it, or I don't want to be somebody's target, and nor will my neighbors.
Hey, calm down. No one's going to hassle you with that in your front yard.
I will not have that in my front yard. You must be crazy. I wouldn't threaten to use that thing and get blown up myself.
Yeah, but you'd still have your submarine.
Oh my God. Listen, I've got no water except in the bathtub. Take it away.
Hey, we'll dig a pool. We'll dig a pool in the back. You better have it with all that hardware out front. You won't be safe unless you've got some strategic force in reserve. And if the neighbors complain, give them a little whiff of this nerve gas.
Get out of here and take all that junk with you.
No way, lady. In a free country, you get what you pay for. This is a session on war tax resistance and war refusal. I'm Tom Witt.
And Marilyn Finn.
There are many kinds of tax resistance, as Paul Kaler, is it? Could tell you, he's a tax collector from California. But this is specifically on war tax resistance because of the firm belief of many people that of the immorality of modern war and the taxes levied to support that war. There are also many reasons for war tax resistance. Many people resist because they believe it a very rational stance to take. Others resist because they're humanists and they believe it's inhumane to pay for something that kills. There are nuclear pacifists who aren't necessarily opposed to all war, or they weren't opposed to war until nuclear war became a big possibility, but they believe now that war is immoral because of nuclear weapons. There are anarchists who believe that the government certainly can't manage things as shown by the arms race, and therefore they should try to withhold all their money, not let the government get a hold of it, not give the government any support. Some believe tax resistance to be a very un-American thing to do. Others believe tax resistance to be very patriotic and very pro-American. And it's also a stance that more and more Christians are taking seriously, precisely because they believe it to be a faith issue. So there are many ways to approach this controversial subject of war tax resistance. But since we do live in a Christian community at Holden, we'd first like to look at the relation of the payment of taxes to our faith and what the Bible has to say, if anything, about the payment of taxes. You need to know that we're also starting with the assumption, this goes for both tonight and tomorrow night, we're starting with the assumption that the Bible does have lots to say about opposition to violence and advocates other ways of dealing with our friends and our enemies on both a personal level and a social level. I'm making this assumption clear from the beginning that as Christians we should be opposing the arms race. I'm not making that assumption because we'd all agreed on that, and not because there's not more to talk about it on that issue, but we'd like to spend time tonight and tomorrow night on this particular issue of our own personal connection to war through the payment of taxes. It's becoming an increasingly important issue, more publicized. It might have hit you already, some of you who live in Washington and have followed the religious news. In the spring, I think it was, Reverend Raymond G. Hunthausen, a Roman Catholic Archbishop of Seattle, has proposed that a sizable number of people in the state undertake a taxpayers' revolt to protest the buildup in nuclear arms. Anyway, I wanted to tell you that we're starting with the assumption that we as Christians should be opposed to the arms race, if not out of a New Testament love for our enemies, at least for the sake of our own children. And if anyone would like to have further discussion on that topic, on whether or not to oppose the arms race, I think we need more of that. Janet Grant is our village philosopher. You could talk to her and we could have a forum or another time for discussion on that, but we'd like to stick to the topic of tax resistance tonight and tomorrow night. We hope that regardless of your position now, that you'll at least be open to hearing about war tax resistance. We're not trying to convince anyone that tax resistance is the only way to work against the arms race. Our agenda tonight is to look at some of the biblical issues surrounding payment of taxes, and maybe have a little bit of discussion. Tomorrow night we'll devote to different methods of tax resistance, what some people have done and the consequences, and open it up for further discussion. So, if you want to come.
Before Tom shows us how the current federal budget is divided and what portions of our income taxes go to specific expenditures, military versus human resources, etc., I think it would be helpful if we shared a common understanding of where income taxes come from. They were not proclaimed as one of the things made during the 6 days of creation. They're much newer than that. So I'll read you a section out of a very helpful book called People Pay for Peace, A Military Tax Refusal Guide. We'll give you some names and addresses tomorrow and articles and things so that you can pursue this issue on your own. So some historical background of income tax. An income tax was first imposed on the citizens of the United States in 1862 as a direct result of the Civil War. It was generally known by the populace as a war tax. This tax was abolished in 1872. In 1913, the 16th Amendment was passed, which authorized Congress to collect taxes on incomes. Shortly afterwards, with the start of World War I, the rate of income taxes was raised quite sharply. The World War I tax laws were designed to meet one-third of the total war costs. The tax rate declined after World War I. After U.S. entrance into World War II, income taxes were raised to the highest level in history. Between 1940 and 1945, war spending accounted for 80% of the federal budget. 40% of this money came from income taxes. This was a higher percentage than the Civil War or World War I. Also, between 1940 and 1945, the number of taxable individuals was raised from 4 million to 30 million. Before World War II, 16.7% of the total population paid an average tax of $99. During the war, 55.9% paid an average of $343. Again, there was a decline in tax rates after World War II until the start of the Korean War in 1950. Congress then revised personal income and corporate taxes to World War II levels or higher. Due to the Cold War, since 1950, U.S. citizens have been subjected to tax rates far in excess of World War II rates. In 1977, of the $360 billion in the federal budget, approximately 52% was marked for war-related expenditures. 36% of the federal budget was derived from individual income taxes. That's just a short history. The figures, of course, have changed through time and continue to change through time as Congress approves new budgets and new apportionings of federal income taxes. And perhaps it's a good place to note here that the federal government also gets money to fund certain programs from trust funds rather than income taxes. That's the way highways and airlines are supported in addition to Social Security. So there are a number of sources of income for the federal government, but the income tax has been a major chunk of it in certain parts of our history and has often been connected to wars or preparation for wars or paying for wars after the fact. We'll take a look now at the 1982 proposed fiscal budget. Can you see this okay? Is the light there?
I'll explain it. This is the federal budget, the United States fiscal year 1982, as close as we could come to it. There are lots of different ways to figure out the federal budget, especially the Defense Department. There are conflicting figures because of the difference in the way people figure it out. As far as military budget goes, military budget no longer includes it doesn't include military aid to other countries included in the foreign aid budget. So now that's in foreign aid, it's not in military aid. Also, some weapons and some weapon systems are financed by the Department of Energy. I think that is included in this pie here. Currently, the latest figures, 55% of the tax budget goes to military, past and present. 38% is current military. In the past is made up of veterans benefits at 6%, and 17% goes to interest on past wars and debts to past wars. So 55%, that's up from 52, which was last year, 52%. And then the rest, human resources, physical resources, and general government make up 26%, 6%, and 13%. I came across these figures. This is President Carter's proposed 1982 budget. So it doesn't allow for what the Reagan administration has done, and we don't have the figures on that. I don't think, I don't have them. If anybody else has them, I'd be welcome to hear them. But I'm sure that they're higher. The Defense Department is split up into research and development, operations and maintenance, weapons purchase, but the total is 180, that's in billions of dollars. Not millions, but billions of dollars. Veterans benefits is 24.95 billion, and interest on past wars is 49.85 billion. So the total is 259 billion, 500 million. Is that right? The way that breaks down is means that on the average, each person in the United States will pay nearly $1,200 for the military in fiscal year 1982. That's for the average person. You have to figure out whether you're average. I don't know what the average person is. By diverting approximately 5% of this $259 billion, if you take 5% of that, of the 1982 proposed military budget, we could achieve eradication of protein malnutrition in children, food production to prevent famine, primary school for all children, create an international disaster relief force, achieve literacy for all adults, eradicate malaria, prevent anemia, and prevent vitamin A deficiency blindness. All of this could be done throughout the world with just 5% of the proposed 1982 military costs. So overkill from bombs is not the only kind of overkill that we pay for when we pay our taxes. I think maybe many of us who are Lutherans or other faiths might pay up to two, three, four times as much for military purposes through tax dollars now as for all church activities. Maybe that's another way to sort of bring it home. I think this also brings out the drastic change in modern warfare during the last century. As long as you had to have huge armies to make war possible, then if you didn't believe in killing, if you thought war was immoral, then conscientious objection to the use of your own personal services was an appropriate witness. But when it becomes possible through automated warfare to have unmanned aircraft and ICBMs and minimal personnel, then the witness of withholding your economic support may become even greater importance for Christians. And I think that's especially true for those of us men who are over the draft age. I think that includes senior citizens and women. Conscientious objection has usually just meant or has been has applied toward men of draft age who have chosen to exercise their conscience. But now I think war has, we're all really directly tied to it because war demands less of our person than it does of our pocket right now. So if we're troubled about war, we should be troubled about taxes.
And I just add one
sure.
small thing. I'm involved in some of these things, so I know a little bit about them. I do know that the economics in this country are such that the present administration is very concerned about no deficit in 1984, and the Secretary of Defense, Secretary Weinberger, has submitted to the White House a plan for reducing the defense budget by $80 billion. He's not recommending that because he's trying to establish a strong defense, but the situation is very, very fluid.
I heard that that David Stockman has decided that the United States will not make the balanced budget unless they do more drastic cutting. For the first time, they did mention possibilities in cutting the Defense Department, but that's been the first talk of that.
The numbers have actually been submitted to the White House.
That would be a cut in the increase of military, right? I don't think that would be a cut to the budget.
I guess I'm not.
The proposed increase will go up to, well, $420 billion by 1985.
So that would be a reduction in the increase. I forgot to mention, if you have any questions throughout, feel free to ask. We would do well tonight to avoid two extremes or two pitfalls, which I don't think the scriptures would support. The one extreme would be to claim that the Bible commands us to pay our taxes in every situation and under any circumstances. One of the biggest hurdles for us to overcome, as Donald Kaufman says, is in considering war tax refusal, is the almost universal assumption that the Bible speaks with one voice concerning the necessity of paying taxes to government in all situations. We'll try to look at that tonight. There doesn't seem to be that kind of absolutist position in the Bible. The Bible does not command us to pay all of our taxes all of our time. I think at the same time we need to avoid the other extreme, the non-payment of taxes. That's also very hard to bring out of the Bible. It's hard to find biblical support for the anarchist position that we should try to avoid as much as possible paying taxes. There are just too many biblical guidelines that point to God's creation of powers and principalities and the necessity for Christians to be subject for the common good. So there is biblical support for the payment of taxes. I don't want that to be confusing. I don't want it to sound like we're talking about the Bible saying that we should never pay taxes. The question is war taxes, and it's important to keep that context in reference to the biblical message. And it's also important to keep the context in reference to the tax situation of that day or in Bible times or at the times of Jesus. And Marilyn will take that.
Before we look at two specific portions of the New Testament which directly deal with the question of payment of taxes, that's Jesus' discussion with Peter over the payment of the temple tax and his confrontation with the Herodians and the Pharisees over the payment of the Caesar's tax. To set the tax situation of Palestine at the time of Christ into context, so we know the background out of which Jesus and his contemporaries would have been speaking, there's an article called The Bible on Tax Resistance by Dale W. Brown. It was printed in Sojourners Magazine, and he gives some helpful historical work so that we can kind of imagine what tax bracket they fell into in those days. Under Herod the Great, between 37 and 4 BC, the tax burden had become unbearable. Though first approving the rebuilding of the temple, the Jewish people reached the point of resistance to a luxurious court and a building program out of all proportion to the national wealth. There was a land tax, a poll tax, personal property taxes, export and import customs on salt and numerous items. The burden was intensified by the fact that there were two complete systems of taxation. In addition to the tribute due to foreign rulers, there was an annual half-shekel payment to the temple. It is estimated that the total taxation at the time of Jesus, civil and religious, totaled from 30 to 40% of the total income. It is not surprising, then, that the scribes and Pharisees spoke of tax collectors and sinners in the same breath, reference to Luke 5:30. The Jews of Palestine felt free from obligations to pay the tribute. Payment was often regarded as an acknowledgement of Caesar as Lord. Since the form of idolatry most repugnant to the Jews was emperor worship, his image was detested. As Daniel Kaufman, who says in What Belongs to Caesar, quote, "The extremists bluntly asserted that any act of submission to Caesar, such as paying a tax, was treason to God," end quote. How do the gospel writers place Jesus in this context? In answer to the query about his eating and drinking with tax collectors, Jesus neither approved what they were doing nor rejected them as persons. Instead, he affirmed that he had come to call sinners to repentance. Since some biblical scholars find evidence that as many as half of the special 12 chosen by Jesus were from the extremist or zealot party, it is maintained that Jesus identified with many of their sentiments concerning the righteousness and justice of the coming kingdom. At the same time, he could not identify with their deep hatred and violent plans. To skip down a bit, we do not possess certain evidence that Jesus was or was not an active teacher of tax resistance. If he was, it is fairly certain that he was a different kind of tax resister than his zealot associates. This broader context should be kept in mind as we examine the specific passages which are appropriated as proof text for this issue. There's some extra Bibles right here. If you need one, raise your hand and we'll pass one around to you. The first text I'd like to take a look at is Matthew 17, verses 24 to 27. Find that, and I'll ask for one of you to volunteer to read that out loud for us. Matthew 17, verses 24 to 27.
Anybody need any more Bible?
There are plenty. someone want to go ahead and start in verse 24?
When they came to Capernaum, collectors of the half shekel tax went up to Peter and said, "Does not your teacher pay the tax?" He said, "Yes." And when he came home, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take toll or tribute? From their sons or from others?" And when he said, "From others," Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook, and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself."
Okay. It's important to note in this passage that Jesus is referring to a tax that was called for in the Book of the Covenant. In Exodus, we have what's now the Book of the Covenant encased in Exodus. And that was a commandment as part of the understanding of what it meant to be within the Jewish covenant, was that every Jewish man over the age of 20 was to pay a yearly tax of one half shekel, regardless of your wealth or your poverty, in support of the temple, so that, maintenance and upkeep, if you will. Peter has been confronted by the collectors of this half shekel tax. The tax collectors of his day came to him and asked him if Jesus paid this tax. And Peter says yes. Then kind of ironically goes back to Jesus and asks, Jesus, without even any pre-discussion apparently with Peter, knows what Peter's going to talk about and wants to get Peter's opinion. And in response to the question, "From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tribute?" In other words, who usually pays tribute to kings? From their sons, from their children, or from others? And he says, from others, and that the sons are free. The interpretation by Dale Brown and John Howard Yoder and some other biblical scholars is that Jesus was responding by saying that those closely related to a king aren't required to pay tribute. That's for those outside that close family tie. There was a controversy within Palestine on this very issue as to who should pay this half shekel tax. The Pharisees believed that one was legally bound to pay this tax as part of the understanding of what it meant to be in covenant with Yahweh. The Sadducees, another party within the Jewish faith family there, believed that this should be a free will offering of the rich. Those who could afford to pay it should pay as much as they felt like contributing, be that half a shekel or more than half a shekel. It's obvious from Jesus' response that he did not think that this half shekel temple tax was compulsory for him, but it's good to note that so that, what are the words there? Not to give offense to them. He gets Peter to go out and go fishing, and the first fish he pulls out of the sea has a shekel inside so that he can pay for Peter and himself the annual fee. How this has often been used historically in Christianity has been as a proof text that, yes, of course you pay your taxes. What's important to note is that this is a specifically religious tax. It is not a military tax, and that it is for the support and the upkeep of the worship center of all Israel. So there's some things we can bring across the bridge, perhaps, in asking how does this passage relate to our modern taxation system and the whole question of war taxes. And that's to say that Jesus here did pay a tax. It was not a war tax. It was not intended for the harm of any other human beings.